Hey guys, this is Guillaume Joshi with Superior North. Welcome back to my channel. Today we will be talking about Rio Tinto. Rio Tinto explores, mines, and processes natural resources worldwide. The company was featured in the Barron's newspaper recently, where the author talked about how the management is now investing in resources and minerals that are needed in the alternate energy market, such as the Argentina-based lithium project. In this video, we'll briefly go over the company's business, then review the company's fundamentals by focusing on its key ratios, and finally find the intrinsic value of the company. So let's dive in and review Rio Tinto.
Hey guys, let's start off by looking at the company profile. Rio Tinto searches for and extracts a variety of minerals worldwide, with the heaviest concentration in North America and Australia. Iron ore is the dominant commodity, with significantly less contributions from aluminum, copper, diamond, gold, and industrial minerals. The 1995 merger of Rio Tinto Zinc Corporation and ConZinc Rio Tinto of Australia via a dual-listed structure created the present-day company. The two operate as a single business entity. Shareholders of each company have equivalent economic and voting rights. The last three sentences just give us a brief background of Rio Tinto's history and how it got created. When it comes to ADRs, each ADR is equivalent to one share of Rio Tinto. Now let's look at the company's annual report to get a better idea of the company's operating segments. Over here, we can see that the company has four reportable segments. Its iron ore segment, aluminum segment, copper and diamond segment, and energy and materials segment. Principal activities for the iron ore segment include iron ore mining and salt and gypsum production in Western Australia. The principal activities for aluminum mining include bauxite mining, alumina refining, and aluminum smelting. Principal activities for copper and diamond segment includes mining and refining of copper, gold, silver, molybdenum, and other byproducts. It also includes copper mining, sorting, and marketing. And finally, the principal activities for the energy and minerals segment includes products such as uranium, bauxite, titanium dioxide, feedstock, and its coal operations. Now let's look at the gross product sales across these four operating segments. We can see that for the year 2020, the iron ore segment brought in more than half of the company's total reportable sales. When we look at the company's capital expenditure, we can see that the iron ore segment was the most expensive, and that makes sense since that's the biggest money maker for the company, so it spends the most dollar amount on the iron ore segment. However, when we compare the capital expenditures to the product sales, we can see that the copper and diamond was the most capital intensive, as the company had to spend about $1.9 billion in capital expenditure to get about $5.4 billion in sales. Iron ore, on the other hand, the company spent about $3 billion to get about $27.5 billion in sales. Now that we have a brief understanding of the company's business and its four operating segments, let's review the company's fundamentals by focusing on its key ratios. Hey guys, now let's look at the key ratios. I'm on Morningstar looking at Rio Tinto. Under key ratios, we have the financials. The first item on the list is the revenue. The revenue is the top line of the income statement. This is the amount of money that the company brings in via sales. Back in 2011, the company's revenue was about $60 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $58 billion. When we look at the past 10-year trend, we can see that the company's revenue was declining all the way through about 2016. And ever since then, the company's revenue has slowly been trending upwards. Ideally, we want the company's revenue to be staying steady or increasing. Next, looking at the operating income. The operating income is the amount of money that's left with the company once we subtract the cost of goods and operating expenses from the company's revenue. Back in 2011, the company's operating income was about $22.8 billion. It declined all the way to about $6 billion back in 2015, and ever since then, the company's operating income has been trending upwards. For the trailing 12 months, the company's operating income was about $28.7 billion. Next, looking at the net income. The net income is the amount of money that's left with the company once it pays for the cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes. In other words, the net income is the bottom line of the income statement. Back in 2011, the company's net income was about $5.8 billion, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $18.8 billion. Ideally, we want to see the company's net income, operating income, and revenue to have a similar trend. That is, we want these numbers to be staying steady or increasing. However, given the cyclicality of this business, it's not uncommon to see a couple of years where the company's net income turns negative. After that, looking at the dividends per share, back in 2011, the company paid out about $1.16 per share as dividend, and for the trailing 12 months, that number has grown to about $4.64 per share. Rio Tinto has been hiking its dividends every year since 2016. Next, looking at the shares outstanding, back in 2011, the company had 1,936 million shares outstanding. And for the trailing 12 months, that number has decreased to 1,617 million shares outstanding. Ideally, we want to see the company's shares outstanding number to be staying steady or decreasing. We can see that Rio Tinto's shares outstanding number has been trending downwards, which is great news for existing shareholders, as when a company buys back its shares, it actually helps increase the existing shareholders' ownership within the company. We can see that the way the company has been hiking its dividends and the way it has been buying back its shares, we can safely say that the management is shareholder friendly. Next is the book value per share. The book value is what we get when we subtract the company's total liabilities from its total assets. Said differently, the book value is the same thing as shareholders' equity. Back in 2012, the company's book value was about $33.2 per share. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $32.71 per share. Over the past 10 years, the company's book value per share has always been positive, which tells us that the company always had more assets than liabilities on its balance sheet. Finally, looking at the free cash flow. The free cash flow is what we get when we subtract the company's capital spending from its operating cash flow. Back in 2011, the company's free cash flow was about $7.7 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number had grown to about $17 billion. Ideally, we wanted the company's free cash flows to be positive, staying steady or increasing. There was only one unique year back in 2012 when the company's free cash flow was negative, which was primarily because the company's capital spending exceeded its operating cash flow. I will be using the 2020 free cash flow number of $9,686 million for my discounted free cash flow DCF analysis, because we can see that this number is fairly comparable to the free cash flows that we have seen in the previous years. The trailing 12-month free cash flow is highly inflated, so it would give me a high intrinsic value number, which would not really make sense. So I will be using the 2020 free cash flow number for my discounted free cash flow DCF analysis. Next, looking at the profitability of the company, focusing on the net margin. The net margin is the ratio of the company's bottom line to its top line, so it compares the company's net income to its revenue. Back in 2011, the company's net margin was about 9.62%, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 32.17%. What this means is every $100 that the company made in sales over the past 12 months, by the time it paid for its cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes, it had $32.17 left as pure profit. Next, looking at the return on equity. The return on equity is the ratio of the company's net income to its shareholders' equity. Warren Buffett prefers to only invest in securities that have a return on equity of 8% or greater every year for the past 10 years. Back in 2011, the company's return on equity was about 10.51%. For the year 2020, it was about 22.31%. And for the trailing 12 months, it was about 40.71%. There were 3 years back in 2015, 2013, and 2012 when the company reported a return on equity that was less than 8%. The three ways of reporting high return on equity numbers are first, when the company becomes more leveraged. In other words, when it takes on more debt, it can report high return on equity numbers. Second is by reporting a high net income number. So if the company's sales grows, it should have its bottom line net income number grow as well. And third is when the company buys back its shares. It decreases the denominator, that is the shareholder's equity, which helps company inflate its return on equity numbers. Next is the return on invested capital. This number gives us an idea of how good the management is at allocating the company's capital and getting a return on that investment. Back in 2011, the company's return on invested capital was about 8.26%. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 31.8%. The company's weighted average cost of capital, also known as the company's hurdle rate, is about 5.35%. And since the company's weighted average cost of capital is less than the company's return on invested capital, we can safely say that the management is creating value for its shareholders. Finally, looking at the interest coverage. The interest coverage is the ratio of the company's income to its interest obligations. So it gives an idea of how many times can the company pay off its interest obligations using its income in that calendar year. Back in 2011, the company's interest coverage was about 27.6 times, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 51 times. Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing, preferred to only invest in securities that had an interest coverage of 5 times or higher. Now let's look at the financial health and liquidity ratios. The first item on the list is the current ratio. The current ratio compares the company's current assets to its current liabilities. Ideally, we want the company's current ratio to be greater than 1.0, as that tells us that the company has enough assets to fulfill its liabilities over the next 12 months. It would be even better to see a current ratio that's greater than 1.5. Back in 2011, the company's current ratio was at 1.46, and for the latest quarter, it's at 2.13. Next is the quick ratio. The quick ratio is similar to the current ratio, except we disregard the inventory component. In other words, quick ratio is equal to current assets minus inventory divided by current liabilities. A quick ratio greater than 1.0 tells us that the company does not have to rely on selling its inventory in order to fulfill its current liabilities. Back in 2011, the company's quick ratio was at 1.05, and for the latest quarter, it's at 1.76. Both the current and quick ratios show that the company is liquid and is not in a financial bind. After that, looking at the financial leverage, the financial leverage is the ratio of the company's total assets to its shareholders' equity. A financial leverage of 1.0 tells us that all of the company's assets are financed via shareholders' equity. A high financial leverage tells us that more of the company's assets are financed via liabilities. Back in 2012, the company's financial leverage was at 2.28, and for the latest quarter, it's at 1.95. Over the past 10 years, the company's financial leverage has stayed fairly consistent. Finally, looking at the debt-to-equity ratio, the debt-to-equity ratio compares the company's total debt to its shareholders' equity. Ideally, we want the company's debt-to-equity ratio to be less than 1.0. It's even better if it's less than 0.5. Back in 2011, the company's debt-to-equity was at 0.39, and for the latest quarter, it's at 0.25. Both the financial leverage and debt-to-equity ratio show that the company is not overextending itself. In other words, it is living within its means, and it's not trying to finance its growth by taking on debt. Now let's look at the efficiency ratios. The first item on the list is the day sales outstanding. This number gives an idea of how many days go by from the day the company recognizes its sale to the date actually receives cash for that service rendered. Back in 2011, the company's day sales outstanding was about 28 days, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 21 days. Ideally, we want the company's day sales outstanding number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day sales outstanding number is growing rapidly, as that tells us that the company may be aggressive with its accounting as it's trying to recognize its revenue sooner so that it can inflate its income numbers on its income statement. However, in the case of Rio Tinto, we can see that the management is not playing any such accounting tricks, as the company's day sales outstanding number have stayed fairly consistent. Next is the day's inventory. This number gives an idea of how many days does the company's products sit in its inventory before they're sold. Back in 2011, the company's day's inventory was about 51 days, and for the year 2020, it was about 87 days. Ideally, we want the company's day's inventory number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day's inventory number is growing rapidly, as it tells us that the company's products are just sitting around as assets on the company's balance sheet, and we as investors want to see those assets being pulled off the balance sheet and being shown as income on the company's income statement. However, for a commodity-like business, it's not uncommon to see periods where the company builds up on its inventory. Next is the payables period. This number gives an idea of how many days does the company take to pay its suppliers. Back in 2011, the company's payables period was about 80 days, and for the year 2020, it was about 70 days. Ideally, we want the company's payables period to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose payables period is growing rapidly, as that tells us that the company's management is holding on to its cash in order to artificially inflate its cash flow numbers on its cash flow statement. However, Rio Tinto's management does not seem to be playing any such accounting tricks, as the company's payables period has stayed fairly consistent over the past few years. Finally, looking at the inventory turnover goes hand in hand with the day's inventory. However, the inventory turnover gives an idea of how many times does the company go through its inventory in a calendar year. Back in 2011, the company went through its inventory about 7.21 times, and for the year 2020, it was about 4.20 times. Ideally, we want the company's day's inventory number to be staying steady or increasing. Now let's look at the company's current valuation. The first item on the list is the price-to-earnings ratio. Rio Tinto's price-to-earning is at 6.5, its price-to-book is at 2.6, price-to-sales is at 2.1, price-to-cash flow is at 5.1, and finally, the company has a dividend yield of 9.1%. When we compare Rio Tinto's current valuation to its 5-year average, we can see that on all the valuation metrics other than the price-to-book ratio, the company's current valuation is undervalued to its 5-year average. If we compare Rio Tinto to the S&P 500, and we can think of S&P 500 as our opportunity cost, as it's the aggregate of the top 500 companies in the United States, we can see that on all the valuation metrics, Rio Tinto is undervalued when compared to the S&P 500. Now let's look at Rio Tinto's discounted free cash flow DCF analysis. Over here, I pasted the company's 2020 free cash flow number that I got from Morningstar, which was at $9,686 million. I'm using an annual growth rate of free cash flow to be 6%. What this means is I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 6% every year for the next 10 years. I'm using a discount rate of 10%. What this means is I want this investment to give me a 10% return. I like a discount rate of 10% because I think about rule of 70, where if we divide 70 by the discount rate, it gives us how many years would it take for us to double our investment. So if we divide 70 by 10, it gives us 7 years. For me, 7 years is the maximum that I want to wait to double my investment. If you want to double your investment even faster, then you would have to increase your discount rate, which would bring down your intrinsic value. Next, I'm using a long-term growth rate of 2.125%. This is the same as the US 30-year treasury yield. And what this means is I expect Rio Tinto's free cash flow to grow at 2.125% after the 10-year mark into perpetuity. The company has 1,617 million shares outstanding and has a long-term debt of $12,302 million. After taking all of these inputs into account, we get the company's intrinsic value to be about $93 per share. When we compare this intrinsic value to the company's current stock price, which is about $75 per share, we can see that the company's current stock price is trading about 19% below its intrinsic value. The way we calculate this intrinsic value is we look at what the free cash flows would be every year for the next 10 years. We sum up all those free cash flows, which come out to about $79 billion. Then we look at what the free cash flows would be after the 10-year mark into perpetuity. We sum all these up to get the intrinsic value to be about $163 billion. From this number, we subtract the long-term debt and divide by the shares outstanding to get the intrinsic value per share to be about $93 per share. Now, if we disregard the perpetuity component, in other words, if you think that Rio Tinto is only going to grow for the next 10 years and then it'll cease to exist, then we get the intrinsic value without the perpetuity to be about $41.5 per share. If we disregard the debt, in other words, if you think that Rio Tinto is going to grow into perpetuity, so there's no point for the company to worry about paying off its debt, then we get the intrinsic value without the debt to be about $100 per share. Finally, let's try to figure out what kind of return can we expect to get on this investment if you were to invest in the company at the current stock price. For this, I'll set my sell, that is my intrinsic value, to my $75.4 per share, which is my current stock price. By changing my discount rate, I get 11.5%. What this means is if I were to purchase a share of Rio Tinto at the current stock price, I can expect to get an annual return of about 11.5% on this investment. So let's wrap it all up. We saw that Rio Tinto has good fundamentals. It is undervalued not only from a discounted free cash flow DCF analysis standpoint, but also when we compared the company's current valuation to that of its five-year average, we saw that the company is undervalued. Rio Tinto is actively addressing climate change concerns. It plans on reducing its carbon emissions by 50% over the next 10 years. The company plans to power many of its facilities using renewable energy and spends heavily in research and development to improve its manufacturing, including ELYSIS, which is a system that provides carbon-free method of producing metals. Rio Tinto is working to supply specialized materials to alternate energy markets by buying Argentina-based Rincon Lithium Project, which was featured in the January newsletter of Barron's. Rio Tinto is also in partnership with IncoBat, which is a European battery technology company. Hey guys, that is all I had for you this week. Hopefully you found this video on Rio Tinto interesting. If you like this content, please do like, share, comment, and subscribe. And if you have any suggestions on which stock I should review next, please leave it in the comment section below. I'll greatly appreciate it. Thank you.